Pushkin.
Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now. Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. Before they were legends of outlaw country, they were lost souls looking for their sound. Don't miss Mandy Moore and the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Hear how one woman's vision and her tiny living room, far from Nashville's Music Row, became the epicenter of a musical movement. Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in The Boar's Nest. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest.
Henry Rollins is intense about the things he loves. It's like he's on a mission from God, and he's been that way since his days as Black Flag's frontman in the 80s. Their music was pure aggression. At shows, there was no delineating between the band and the audience. It was all just one big mosh pit, with Rollins physically fighting off the crowd and dodging beer bottles hurled at his head. Real punk rock.
Dallas Coward, ride the pole. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Make this sport what we say. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. Try to stop what we do. Rise above, we're gonna rise above. When they can't.
For nearly 25 years, Henry Rollins toured the world relentlessly. First with Black Flag, then Rollins Band. And most recently, as a spoken word artist. Just before the pandemic, he performed in 21 countries and was a keynote speaker at conferences for things as mundane as software, but also at cannabis conventions, which is funny for someone as famously straight-edge as Rollins. Henry and Rick Rubin, two of the most music-obsessed dudes of all time, met way back in the day. They even started the Infinite Zero label together in the early 90s to reissue long-forgotten albums they both loved. Rick sat with Henry at Shangri-La pre-pandemic, and in full Rollins fashion, the stories just poured out of him. Henry talks about the time he was christened a lead singer by HR from Bad Brains, the day he woke up and realized he was done writing music, and why he'll never be the old guy on stage performing his greatest hits.
This is Broken Record, liner notes for the digital age. I'm Justin Richmond.
Here's Rick Rubin and Henry Rollins.
I was thinking about the fact that both of us have essentially made music our lives, and neither of us, I would say, are particularly virtuoso.
I'm not a musician.
Me either.
I can't play a note on any instrument. All I can do is buy them and carry them upstairs.
Yes.
I can't. I've never wanted to. I mean, I've written songs in my head. I co-wrote a song with George Clinton once, and we hummed it to the band. He's like, I got something. And he hummed. I go, that's King Crimson. How'd you know? I said, I have that record. And he hummed another one. I go, that's one of your own records. Like, oh, man. And then we finally came up with something that he, you know, wasn't already used. And then I hummed something, and we wrote this song together. And neither one of us, he could probably play something, I don't know. But we just found the music by just going, and the band were like this. I'm like, yeah, man. And it was fascinating to be standing in front of these guys sitting. It was at the old Cherokee Studios. Mm-hmm. me and Clinton looking at these guys going do do do, and a song happened.
Yeah,
with no none of us sitting at a piano or anything. Yeah, so if you know what you want to hear, you know, and I've never been a musician. I was angry, and they said, "Here's a microphone, here's a beat, do your thing." All right, that I can do.
Yes.
Like one time, our second bass player Melvin Gibbs, he heard me sing. He goes, "Oh, just put it in E, man." Just I go, "What does that mean?" He's like, "You're E." I didn't know what that meant until later. Like, it's just anyone can hit it, Henry. Just you're safe in E. I'm like, I still don't know what it means, really. I went, I guess that means I suck. Or limited.
What was your first love affair with music? Tell me your first memories of like, this is for me.
A couple of things. Well, my mom had pitch perfect taste in music, and we rarely watched TV, but she would play one record after another. And we'd go to the record store up to three nights a week. My mom was a record buyer. Bartok, Stravinsky, Beethoven, Hendrix, Marian McCabe, Barbara Streisand, show tunes like Porgy and Bess, Miles, Monk, Coltrane. I mean, like perfect taste in music. I don't necessarily need a Barbara Streisand record every day, but those are good records. I mean, she's not messing around.
No, she's incredible.
She's incredible.
Yeah.
Lead Belly, Dylan, both Guthries. My mom is like, her record collection is a mwah. And as a young adult, I went through her record collection as like a 20-something who knew a thing or two. And I went, wow, Miles Davis. Like, how come it stops it in a silent way? She goes, I stopped understanding Miles at a certain point. And she said, I used to go see Miles and Coltrane all the time. I said, you saw Miles? And she goes, yeah, together, separately. I'm like, you're killing me. I had no idea how cool my mom was. So I was raised in good music, but the thing that really knocked me out was Ringo drumming on Sgt. Pepper. I'm like, oh, I'm like 8 years old, hyperactive, and just bouncing off the walls of my little room. My mom gave me Beatles records as electric babysitters, so I just play them over and over again. But it was Ringo on the outro version, the outro Sgt. Pepper riff on the way out of the record, mm-hmm. where he's just like naked, just doing that stacked up Ringo beat. And I said, that's what I'm talking about. I didn't even know what I was into. I just liked that.
Yeah.
And that plays in my head all the time.
Yeah.
And that was the hook. And the first things I bought when I made money, like throwing newspapers, was records. And I bought a bike and records. It wasn't candy, drugs. It was music. And I, you know, records were $4.99 back when Carter was president. And I would make my money and go buy my $4.99 Some Girls, Fly Like an Eagle, Rocks, Toys in the Attic, you know, whatever was what was up. And so
how old are you at this time? 15, 14?
Yeah, I was buying records steadily. By the time I was 14, I was at school one time, at prep school, all boys, and I walked by one of the major jocks. He's got one of those one speaker tape decks, and he's got this crazy music coming from, and I took all the courage I could summon, like, excuse me, sir, what are you listening to? And he looked at me like I was the dumbest guy on the planet. He's like, Ted Nugent, like, get a clue. I was like, duly noted. And I went to the record store after school that day, because I always worked. I always had little pocket money. And I bought Free For All. And then I went backwards and bought the first album. And those are the Ted Nugent records that were out. And I put them on. I'm like, oh, there it is. That's what I'm talking about. And then a couple of years later, me and Ian MacKay saw him live. And that was kind of like one of the best things I've ever seen. And it was like, to this day, top five live gigs I've ever seen in my life. And I've seen quite a few gigs. And so music was an obsession all through high school, because it was the escape from the drudgery of an all-boys prep school where I was a hyperactive, Ritalin addled student who didn't do well on any level in school. And that's when me and Ian MacKay from Fugazi and Minor Threat, our friend, we were gig guys. We would just go to see the everybody, Van Halen, Aerosmith, Zeppelin, we saw everything we could. And then when punk rock hit, that's when music became like, it went into the red as far as collector guy, need to know too much about everything, hair splitting, you know, magnifying glass out, looking at the label, where I, you know, took way better care of my records and just became super vinyl obsessive.
What was the first punk record for you? First one you heard, first one you got?
First one I heard was the first Ramones album. I was kind of birthed purely.
Yes.
I read about these bands. You're like, what's this punk rock craze? And I had Nugent Records. That was my crazy music. And a guy in my neighborhood who's on a lot of the early Discord records, Roberto, Bert Quiraz. Bert was like the cool kid. He just a sharp guy, really sharp guy, has his ear to the ground. And he knows about import records. And one day we're at the skate ramp. And I said, you know, my music no longer addresses my issues. I was like 16 and mad at everything. 17, whatever. I was just pissed. And like, you know, Fly Like an Eagle, great record. It's just not cutting it. You know, I don't understand the poetry, the lyrics. I want to, you know, meet a girl and burn something to the ground. And so he said, come with me. So I went to his microscopic apartment he shared with his mom. He was like, I'm going to loan you this record. I need it back tomorrow. It was first Ramones album. And my mom wasn't home from work yet. So I put it on her nice speakers, not my crappy GE in my room. And I heard the first Ramones album. And I don't get it. There's a joke record. These four morons on the cover. That's not a rock band. They don't look like ELO. Like, what's their problem? And then you get to the end of it. Like, okay, that's funny. That's not. Then you play it again because he said you need to play it three times. I'm like, okay. It's a 30-minute record. It's
great advice. Great advice.
Yes, three times. Because the first two times, the first time you're like, this is hilarious.
Yeah.
Second time you're like, and then the third time you're like, oh, light bulb. And you're like, this is my band. And with great regret and some reluctance, I hit the prize it from my grasp. And then he said, okay, here's your next lesson, first Clash album. He goes, that's an import, be careful. I go, what's an import? He goes, that's a day's pay. That's what that is. $20 record in 1979 or whatever. Took the Clash record back, and still to this day, one of my favorite records. And those records blew my mind. I just didn't know you could do that with, I didn't know you could say that in a lyric. Have not so many instruments on a record. I'm used to ELO, 90 keyboards and, you know, I love those records.
Yeah,
you know,
big production.
I walked through the snow to buy Out of the Blue or whatever the big double album is. I love that record, but it's like 80 of everything and it's all so perfect you can't get near it. With the Ramones, you hear the cracks, like, oh, those are humans. And I never thought I could do that, but you look at them, I could approach those guys. You're never going to meet Robert Plant, but you could meet one of those guys. And all of a sudden, I went from seeing Led Zeppelin at the Capitol Center, it's gone now, with Ian, to seeing February 15th, 1971, seeing Bo Diddley opening for The Clash.
Wow.
And he said, he looks at the crowd, a bunch of little, like all 150 of us. You remember the coolest thing you could have was a 55 Chevy and a girl at your side? We're like, yay. He's like, no, you don't. We're like, okay, whatever. We're just trying to be there with you, man. And so Bo Diddley played. He was brought there. He's a DC guy. So he walked to the show. He lived right down the street.
Wow.
So the Clash requested him because he knew he's a DC native. And then the Clash played and they opened with Janie Jones or Wyatt Riot, something. And it was like getting hit with this blinding white light. And it just seemed to burn. Like, I'm burning. Like, my skin's on fire. This is, like, destroying every notion I have of what music. So I used to watch from, like, a block away. And suddenly, within a year, I'm being sweated on by Didi Ramone. Lux Interior is down to his underwear, landing on me. I'm like, ooh, naked man. Like, it became real. The Bad Brains are breathing on me because I'm standing in front of them at a punk rock party.
Yes.
And that's when music went from this spectator sport to this thing that I knew was going to be my life, even if it's just fanboy, record store go-to guy, going to a gig guy. I never thought of being in a band until one night HR of the Bad Brains, he said, Henry, you're a singer. And I said, no, man, you're the singer. He said, nope, you're a singer. And tonight you're going to be in the Bad Brains. And I'm standing in front of him and he grabbed me by my arm, put me on stage, gave me the microphone, went back down off the stage about as high as the couch we're sitting on, and stood in front of me with his arms crossed. And I knew those songs, we all did. And I just called out a couple mid-tempo ones that I could try and get near. And I sang them. And I remember HR looking at me with this intense scowl like, see? And I was like, oh, well, I guess. Here's your mic back. That was a thrilling 3.5 minutes. And within a few months, I was in a band. But
what was the first band?
SOA is me and some other guy. You know, we weren't that good. We had a lot of fun. Our songs were 44 seconds.
Great.
Gigs were 9 minutes in length. All the songs we had fit on 145, and it's like at least 5.5 minutes of music.
Great.
Yeah.
How long did that band last?
I got into that band. They were pre-existing, And the singer, some guy named Lyle Pressler, he never went anywhere. He was also a really good guitar player. So he moved across town to some band called Minor Threat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, them. Anyway, so Lyle leaves and he leaves behind this band who needs a singer. So I go see his old band, the Extorts, one night, and they're shopping for a singer. So everyone knows who our scene is. You can fit them all in this room. It's not that many people. So they know who I am. I know who they are. So I said, I'll sing with you guys. And they went, okay. I think they're too scared to say no, because they're just, you know, scary guy with no hair. And so suddenly I'm at band practice having to write lyrics, which amazingly was not that difficult. Well, I can't say anything about the quality of the lyrics, but it came to me. I was probably pretty pedestrian, like I'll sing on every snare beat because melody's not my thing. But suddenly I'm in this band and it felt right. It felt really right. It felt like I was a fish dropped into water. No stage fright, none, zero. Like I couldn't wait. And that was October 80. By July 81, I'm in California at Black Flag practice.
How did that happen?
That's crazy. I'll give you the hyper-condensed version. I knew those guys because they would come through town. And when they were in D.C., they'd stay in Ian's mom's basement. So Ian's house is the coolest in D.C. because you could go there and, excuse me, Ms. Mackay, is Ian home? He's downstairs with Black Flag. And so we're all, like, you're in Black Flag. We're just, like, standing there, like, gooey on the inside. So I got to know those guys. And, you know, they're just broke touring band, as I was soon to find out. And they were doing a tour on the East Coast. I met them in March, April. They came back in July, not playing DC. So I took a drove my car up to see them at Irving Plaza. And guest list, I hung out with them all afternoon because I kind of sort of knew them. Drove with them to another show at 2nd and A. And I helped them load in. Me and John Joseph of the Cro-Mags loaded their gear in, watched a guy get stabbed. Like, okay, that just happened. Here's the snare. And I'm looking at my watch. I got to drive to D.C. and do a full shift at Haagen-Dazs on no sleep. But I'm young. I can totally do it. Just one thing of top ramen noodles, I'm good to go. And so I looked at my watch and I said, hey, they're playing this tiny bar. I said, can you guys do a song for me? It's called Clocked In. It's a great riff. And Dez, the great singer at the time, he said, this is for Henry. It's called Clocked In because he's got to go to work. And the audience is like, who's that? And I looked at, I have no memory of this. I looked at Dez and Dez looked at me. And suddenly I'm standing on stage with him. And I must have had quite a look on my face because I looked at him. He just gave me the mic. Like, don't hurt me. Here's the mic. I'm like, okay. And the band was like, oh, Henry's going to sing. I knew the words. It's like a 90-second song. And I sang the words the way I thought those songs should be sung, where like vital organs fly out of your mouth. The audience is terrified. And Rome burns to the ground. And then, rah, 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 I do the thing. And I remember two things. I remember the audience going like, ah, like looking at like they're being assaulted. And Greg and Chuck looking at the center of the stage at me going like, huh, like that's keeping us awake. And I gave the mic back and I got into my wounded 1968 VW Fastback with the dent in the hood from where the mace canister bounced off it when my mom was locked in a traffic jam riot in the 60s. I drive the wounded car to my work, shower in the work sink, pull on a new shirt. And I'm scooping ice cream, thinking I was in Black Flag for 90 seconds. I've been, you know, I'm 20. My life is one humiliation after another. Minimum wage jobs are going to be my life. I got no plan. But man, that was right. I was in the right place. And I got band practice. I go back to work. And the phone rings. It's someone in Black Flag has found the work number. Hey, Henry, we're auditioning singers. Dez wants to move to rhythm guitar. You're pretty crazy last night. You want to come up here to New York and audition? We'll pay your train fare. I'm like, what do I have to lose? I'm 20. I'm going nowhere. $3.75 an hour. I have nothing to lose. And I'm not a tough guy. I don't have a lot of guts and courage. But I said, this is it. This is a shot. This is never happening to me again. No way. Shouldn't be happening now. So I said, I'll be there tomorrow. Give me an address. Met them at Odessa. Mm-hmm. Polish diner's great. A lot of food for cheap. That's why they liked it. I ate there so many times in Black Flag since. Anyway, I said, so what are we doing? I'm still not clear. I said, we're going to go to a practice place and you're going to sing two sets. I said, I don't know any of the words. They hardly have any records out. They said, sucks to be you.
What was out at that point? The Yellow?
Jealous Again, the Yellow 12-inch. Six Pack was the EP they were touring on. And then there was the Damage One and Louie Louie on Posh Boy, the single, and Nervous Breakdown EP. So not much.
Not much.
Not much at all. Not TV party and yes, Rise Above yes, yes, and yes. all the big stuff.
And in your world, what was Black Flag to you at that time?
Before- Everything. To me, it was the ultimate band. And they asked me, like, what's your favorite song of ours? I said, Damage One, the slow one with the wrong chord.
Yeah.
Like, dun, dun, dun. And I was like, that's the song. And they went, you like that? You like the slow one? I'm like, yeah, that's the one that makes me want to go, like, kill everyone. They went, you're all right. They were fascinated that I liked the slow wrong one. Classic Gin weirdo chord, which is genius.
Yeah.
And that was my jam. And they went, okay, you're interesting. And so we get in this tiny practice room and I literally am holding a microphone, a 57, not a 58. And I pinched myself because I didn't believe. I said, so what song you want to start with? I said, well, I didn't even know many of the song titles. I said, Police Story. And Gin has an on-off. He doesn't have a tone thing. He took that out and just put an on-off switch. So in all the early Black Flag records, you hear, and that's just him hitting on, and the thing starts howling with feedback. It's a Dan Armstrong with the pickups floating in resin. So it's a feedback machine. And all I can remember is, and 90 minutes later, we've done every song twice. I'm completely soaked in sweat. I have no real memory of it. All I remember is I just kind of went, ooh, wah, wah, and yelled and screamed. I had fun. And they said, okay, we're going to have a band meeting. You go wait in the front lounge. I ran across the street, got one of those cool glass bottles of Tropicana, not from concentrate. I'm like, cool, living large, $1.35. And I'm sitting there waiting for the verdict, which I figure is going to be like hours. They're going to take out the skull and light the candle and whip out the sacred verses. And have a, they came out in like 3 minutes. And one of them, I think it was Dukowski, said, so matter-of-factly, you're in. I said, excuse me? You're in. I said, in what? In Black Flag. Who? You? Me? Yeah. Doing what? You're the singer. Of who? Black Flag. Because they weren't like, he's like, so you're in. And I was in disbelief. And one of them finally said, do you want the job or not? I was like, yeah, wait a minute. I was scooping ice cream yesterday. Is this happening? Yeah. It was unreal.
Yeah.
So I said, so what do I do? And I forget which, maybe it was Dukowski. He hands me this massive folder of lyrics. And, you know, they were prepared. And they said, you learn these, you go home, you kiss your little mommy goodbye. You quit your job. You give all your stuff away. You pack a bag. Here's the tour itinerary. You meet us as soon as you can. And then one of the road crew guys started laughing. And what's so funny? Like, man, we got to make the album soon. I said, what album? The first Black Flag album. I said, uh-huh. So who's singing on that? And they went, you. Do you get it? I was afraid it would be Dez, like the Farewell Dez album. I didn't know. And I get on the train, numb, like speechless, kind of holding this folder like it's not even mine.
Yeah.
And I go to work, and Ian MacKay calls because there's no internet. He said, where have you been? We talk every day. He said, I said, okay. I left town like yesterday, day before. I didn't have time to tell you anything. So here's what just happened. And I don't ask advice of people. I just go and make a mistake and, you know, limp away. But I asked Ian, I go, so what do you think? He said, are you kidding? This is going to be great.
Yeah.
And so it took me a few days to pack, give things away, including that car, quit my job. And my boss said, well, I'll give you $4 an hour, like, you know, an incentive. I said, I love my job, Steve. We're still friends to this day. I said, I like my job. He helped me get my first apartment. He got me credit. Like he called the landlord and said, I got this. If he screws up, I got this. That's how I got my first apartment. So he means a lot to me. He trusted me with his money. I ran his store, his Haagen-Dazs. And so I said, I got to go. He said, no, you got to do this. This is a shot. You're not going to get this again. So if it craps out on you, you can have your old job back. And I said, man, you never know. I might be back. And a few days later, my old band played with Black Flag in Philadelphia, and I sang the encore with Black Flag. And that was the handing of the baton where Chuck went up to the mic and said, and here's the new singer of Black Flag. And I went out on stage and sang Louie Louie and like one or two others. And everyone kind of went, whatever. And the owner of that club a few years ago sent me the set list.
Wow.
He said, here's the set list where you transitioned into Black Flag. And I went back to DC because I still had to, like, you know, clean up a few things. And a couple of days later, I was on a Greyhound bus overnight to Detroit. I still have the bus ticket. I take a taxi to Clutch Cargo, the now famous punk rock venue. I beat the band there. They're driving from some other city. And I come in with my duffel bag and I walk in. There's a lady behind the bar. She goes, "Can I help you?" I said, you know, I was born polite. I said, "Yes, ma'am." And I had never said this as a declarative sentence to anyone in my life except this lady behind the bar. It's like 2 p.m. She said, "Can I help you?" I said, I'm the singer in Black Flag. Like, not even, I thought she was going to go, "Get out of here." She went, "Oh, would you like a Coke?" I went, "Yes, please."
What was the relationship from the beginning between Greg and Chuck? How did that work?
Founding members.
Yeah.
And left side, right side brain. Dukowski, hard on sleeve, you know, tears up during songs. He's really like just ripped open. Greg is the more hyper analytical. They're both smart, different, but they're utilizing different parts of the brain. And you can see it in the lyrics. Chuck is writing My War. Other stuff was just ripped open emotionally. Greg is coming for the more introspective. Both of them are super effective, great songwriters. But where one is writing, like, you know, Rise Above, Greg, American Waste, which is like, let's burn America to the ground before they kill us all, Chuck. But when you have both sides of the brain, left side, right side, on one record, you have this fully realized introspective person who's mad. And so that's why, like, those early records really work, because all parts of your young, angry, insecure palate are being addressed. You know, you have Hall and Oates.
Yeah.
And it worked. And later on, their relationship became antagonistic, leading, and I'm not talking out of class, it's all documented, leading for Dukowski to eventually sell his share of SST and move on. And so it became Greg's scene.
Do you know what that was about?
It's just about the combination of Greg Ginn and Chuck Dukowski. And if you look at the history of Greg Ginn and everyone in Black Flag and every artist on SST, I'm sure you know quite a bit about this, and anyone wants to take the merest glance onto the internet, I'm not trying to talk out of class. Kind of Greg plus anyone is a turbulent, time-stamped, it will come to an end.
I see.
There is a use-by date, and don't stick around after Monday when the thing is, just leave. And so I left. And so they were an amazing combination. The closest thing that I can, in my life, was Bob Mould and Grant Hart of Husker Du. Two guys, again, Bob Mould, the introspective, analytical, Grant Hart, completely ripped open, both insanely talented, and almost knocked down drag out fights with those two back in the day. Because they're both, you know, getting loaded or whatever. There's this crazy young men. Super talented. But I saw Husker Du and went, "Oh, I'm in a band like that." Where, like, you know, everyone is just like gnarly at all times. And that's why those records sound like they do. Like, you play them now as a man pushing 60. I hear some of those songs every once in a while somewhere. And I go, "Yeah, that's music you make when you're young and hungry and really mad. I can't make that music now because I got too much money in the bank. I eat 3 meals a day and nothing really inconveniences me. And I'm just not there anymore." But when you're young, you're feral. And the way Black Flag lived, it was a constant, like, well, let's hope there's not the second stabbing this week at one of our shows. And so those days, you became your environment.
We'll be right back with Henry Rollins after a quick break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's new StockTrend.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with more from Henry Rollins.
What was the difference in the shows between the UK and the US?
Far less antagonism. In England in those days, you know, Reagan, Thatcher, it was a bunch of people telling you to go home. And I'm a guy who grew up in the record store, so we're opening for the Exploited. I had the dude's records. That was an hour's pay to buy that single. And his road crew would come into our dressing room, take our food. And, you know, we don't want to, you know, they're all these Scottish maniacs. They will kill you. So I take our four bananas and the cold ham sandwich. So we starve. And the singer hated us because we're from America. And he'd go on stage and, like, you know, kill the American wankers. And we opened for Chelsea. And I had those records too, liked them. And the singer, like, hey, California. Hey, Mr. America. I'm like, what have I done to you? And so all these bands were really mean to us, except the Damned and the UK Subs. But all these bands who I had records of were just awful to us. And there's the spitting. And when you're opening for a band, they kind of don't like you. Like when you open for the Damned, the audience wants to see one band. It's not you. And their audience was kind of nice. But the Exploited audience, they just want to beat you up. And we're not shrinking violets either. We're coming on with our thing, which was pretty insane in those days. We're like, you don't like us? We don't like you either. And here it comes. So we came back to America, basically to a hero's welcome. You know, yay, they already knew us. You know, you're an American band or they already had a built-in audience. And so two nights later, you're up in Boston doing two sets and on BCN with Oedipus after the show.
Amazing.
In a heated van. It's all different.
Yeah. Let's talk about the making of the first album.
Sure. It was made in autumn of 1981 at a place which is now a Trader Joe's on Santa Monica Boulevard, a little west of La Cienega. And it was Unicorn Recording Studios. Black Flag lived in the offices above. We slept on the floor. There's a practice room on that floor, so we'd practice there. You'd go downstairs to their offices. Wood paneling, plush carpets, a total 1970s into the 80s studio. Tiny studio, but we didn't need much. It was like a very bare bones environment. We knew the songs, and so we recorded by day with Spot producing. But here's the thing now, everyone's dead, we can talk about it. What Unicorn didn't understand was we live on top of we're in the same building. They go home at 5 p.m., the owner, this receptionist. It's a record company with a studio. At 5 p.m., everyone's out of there. The way to get to the studio from the upstairs is one door. You just turn that little thing in the middle of the knob. You just leave it open. Soon as they're gone, like at 5 p.m., we're like, we're really tired. And they'd leave and we'd leave. At 5:15, we're right back in there. Overdubs, vocals, till about 7:30 in the morning. Open up the doors, air the place out, because it's a bunch of man odor. We've been in there sweating all night, singing the chorus of TV Party 80 times. You air it out, turn everything off, and tiptoe upstairs, sleep for 40 minutes, and come back down, having just clocked a good 12 hours of free time, because we can't afford what it would really cost. And so we would do everything at night, like tons of overdubs, and finish the record at night. And Unicorn probably made plenty off us, but we made that record by using it at night. And who knows if they knew or even cared, but we did that. But we made the record very quickly because of all the demoing and the years of playing those songs on stage. Some of the songs were new, like TV Party was super new, but the rest of them were a couple of years old. So like, it wasn't like anyone had a question about them. You've been playing 100 times. By 83, we're playing the songs that wouldn't be released until 84. In fact, My War, Slip It In, all those, we demoed those in 82.
Wow.
That's how quick Greg and Chuck were writing them. So we're still doing the Damage set, but we're playing the rock stuff. And so we started playing those songs in late 82, September 82, into 83. And the audiences are just like standing there flipping us off. Just like, nope, what is this? And by 84, it's all 7-minute sludgy, slow songs. And the audience was of two minds, either like, man, this has never been better. Like, this is the most intense. Or I hate you guys, and I paid my $5.50 to come here and abuse the singer. And it only became more either with us or against us, because every album was different. By 86, the shows, the audiences were pretty angry because they didn't like the new songs. And a lot of them they hadn't heard. And they wanted the old ones. And they took it out on us. Like, things would hit the stage. Equipment would get abused. The PA would get abused. The players would get abused. The singer would get abused. And so by the end of that, the last tour, it was kind of a miserable hate fest of a record or songs that people weren't that into. Lyrics I didn't quite get along with all that well, and a band that was incredibly unhappy. And I'm not trying to put anyone down. It's just, people are together in a band very intensely. It is what it is. You've been around a few bands in your life, Rick. It's closer than a family.
Yeah,
it's a bunch of crazy creative people all in a compressed space doing the same thing every night, and everything smells like somebody's laundry, and you're like, okay, I hate your guts, so let's go on tour. And that's how it is. As much as those people have made me mad over the years, when it came down to it, I would jump in front of anything bad coming their way. I have to, because we're all in that battlefield, and some of those men make me very angry. But if it was something bad was happening right now, I'd be right there. Like, I got this. Hit me instead.
How did it work that you left the band?
The tour came. The last show was in Detroit, two nights at Greystone. We finished, drove back to LA. Greg had said initially, we're going to take a year off because I'm going to reinvent SST. I'm like, what's that going to be like? Because I never understood an hour off from that band. You were never far away. And I went, a year? That might as well be 10 years. I didn't know what to do. And I was on the East Coast visiting, Ian and all these people. And I get the phone call from Greg. And he said, I quit. And I'll never forget this. I said, it's your band. You can't quit. He said, well, I quit. And I hung up the phone and went, wow, that's that. And when you're a young guy and you go from a minimum wage job, and your first day in LA, you're in the LA Times, and you're in this very intense band with a very strong work ethos, and everything is a big damn deal. And all of a sudden, it's over in a phone call where the jet doesn't land. It kind of drops out of the sky and goes into 1,000 pieces on the ground. and you stagger away from this wrecked bit of shrapnel, you don't go, oh, I'll do, you like, ah, what do I do? How do you breathe? Who am I without Black Flag? And I'll never forget, I read somewhere like on a fortune cookie, if one seeks to change, one must be prepared to seem stupid. And you got to go try new things. Like, okay, and right around that time, I got an offer to audition for a film. And so I went to New York and I auditioned for this film. I have no memory of it. And I'm like, okay, I did that. I'm going to try and act now. And that was July, August. By October, I'm in Leeds, England, making my first solo record. So I realized if I don't hit the ground and run, I'm going to hit the ground and rot. And so my old pal from Washington, D.C., Chris Haskett, he and I grew up together. He had a really good band called The Enzymes in D.C., and he used to live in England. Chris said, as a joke, if Black Flag ever breaks up like that'll happen, you and I should make a record. And I said, okay. And I called him. He happened to be back in America visiting his folks because he was living in Leeds, England. I said, hey, Chris, it's Henry. The eagle has landed. I don't have a band. And he was like, I got a band. I got this. Like, he had been waiting. Like, yeah. He knew before I did. He goes, I have a whole band. They're in Leeds. I know a studio. I got a practice place. You're going to live in my room, and we're going to write songs. I'll see you in England in like 10 days. And I had like $2,500 to my name. I got a standby flight. And I remember getting out of the plane. I took a bus, a coach up to Leeds with like a backpack, and on fear of failure, tons of tea and onion bhajis, Chris Haskett and I wrote like 18 songs in 4 days, recorded them in 5 days, like two takes with his rhythm section from his surf instrumental band. And I said, hi, I'm Henry. I'm about to terrify you with the scariest lyrics you've ever heard. And they heard them like, you're a scary guy. I said, you have no idea. And so we made a record called Hot Animal Machine. And we made this little record for no money. And it's pretty good. And so by April of 87, like less than a year after Black Flag broke up, I'm in band practice in Trenton, New Jersey with Andrew and Sim of Greg Ginn's old instrumental band, Gone, who had broken up, Chris from the Hot Animal Machine record. And we called it the Rollins Band. And almost a year to the day, we're back in Leeds at the same studio. We recorded Hot Animal Machine, recording Lifetime, all new songs we wrote on the road. We road tested them. We played them every night. And since 81, to the end of the Rollins Band, I never really kind of put the mic down. Where is he? He's writing songs. Where is he now? On tour. Where is he now? Making a record. Around and round you go, like AC/DC and everyone else trying to prove it every night. And I did that for damn near 25 years.
Incredible.
You know, and playing more than kind of any band I know of, besides maybe DOA or like the Chili Peppers. They go at it. They're gladiators. You know, they leave for 3 years. You know, they're not kidding around. And we toured. That's what Black Flag taught me. Play every night. And suddenly, you know, we're rocking in Singapore. We're playing in Moscow. You know, I go, you guys into this? They're like, yeah, we're playing in Budapest, Hungary. Who would have thought? And we just basically said yes to every gig. And that's how I tour to this day.
We'll be right back with Henry Rollins after a quick break.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented 3 new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at marketmessage2024.com right now. Again, the link to watch is marketmessage2024.com. That's marketmessage2024.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson. How did the biggest names in outlaw country start a musical revolution? Through one woman's vision from one tiny living room. Don't miss Mandy Moore as Sue Brewer in the new scripted Audible original, The Boar's Nest, Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Discover the true untold story of the extraordinary woman behind the outlaw country music movement and its biggest stars. Brewer helped shape the sound and soul of country music as we know it today, despite never picking up an instrument herself. Lovingly dubbed The Boar's Nest, Sue's place was an intimate staging ground where a new breed of singer-songwriters, wounded souls, wayward upstarts, would spur each other on to tap into something bigger, realer. Starring Mandy Moore and featuring Eben Moss Bacharach as Shel Silverstein and TJ Osborne as Johnny Cash, alongside a full ensemble cast, Audible invites you to enter The Boar's Nest and experience the rise of a musical revolution. One woman, one time, one place. The Boar's Nest. Sue Brewer and the Birth of Outlaw Country Music. Listen now at audible.com/The Boar's Nest. We're back with the rest of Rick's conversation with Henry Rollins.
What was the first speaking engagement you did?
1983. The Harvey Kubernick, a great local tastemaker producer in this town. He used to do these shows where you get 20 people, everyone gets 5 minutes. And Dukowski would read from his little notebooks of doom. He'd talk about the apocalypse or whatever. I would go with Chuck. John Doe would go up and sing a song. Jeffrey Lee Pierce of the Gun Club would read from 5 minutes of his tour journal. It was like really fun. They have real poets, performance artists, movie stars would talk. And I'd go with Chuck. We lived in the beach. I'd go to the big city, look at pretty women, and, you know, be in Hollywood with the real people. And so one night Harvey came up to me at the Lassa Club, I think, and he said, we're doing a show next week. Chuck's on the bill. Why don't you get on the bill? I'm like, what am I going to do? He said, you got a big mouth. You never shut up. 5 minutes, like $10, I think it was. I was like, and all I saw was the money. I was like, $10? How many omelets can I get for 10? Like, that's a lot of huevos rancheros. So I was like, because I'm just hungry all the time. And so, you know, with sheer chutzpah, I went on stage the next week with some writing folded in my ass pocket, read the two things, told a story about what had happened the day before at band practice when a neo-Nazi tried to run over Greg with his car as Greg was on his way to the little store to get a thing of orange juice, which is just Tuesday for Black Flag. The audience, their jaws were on the ground. I said, oh, I got it. My 7 minutes or whatever are up. And huge applause. And I remember two things distinctly. One, I don't need a band in that I have no stage fright. Give me another half an hour. I got this. I love being alone with a microphone. I could be George Carlin. I was raised on all those records. I'm not comparing myself. I'm saying,
yes,
I can get by without a band. And people coming up to me afterwards going, when's your next show? I said, well, I'm leaving on tour. They go, no, not the band. When you just talk. I went, never. I got my $10 bill. Then Harvey came up to me and he said, okay, you're a natural. And I said, whatever. He said, how about this? I book half the poets on tonight's stage. I manage them. Three of them are doing a poetry reading at a bookstore in wherever. Why don't you do 15 minutes and I'll give you $25. Okay. By the end of 83, beginning of 84, some of those poets, much to their chagrin, were opening for me.
Wow.
Because I was drawing people. By the end of Black Flag, in some major cities, I could draw almost as many people as Black Flag on my own. And not everyone in the band was cool about this. And so suddenly, I'm doing radio interviews about my writing and my speaking. I'm on the cover of this magazine because of spoken word. And so I had this whole other thing. And by autumn 85, when the Loose Nut Black Flag tour came to an end, I left almost immediately across America, 12 to 50 people a night, with our old sound man driving the van and doing sound for me. And we just did a talking tour from LA to New York and back. And it just, and then by 85, I got invited to a poetry festival in Holland. Sure, it's me and Linton Kwesi Johnson. And who came up to me after, he said, "Righteous Mr. Rollins." I said, "Thank you, sir." Bill Burroughs was on the bill, Jeffrey Lee Pierce, all kinds of people. And with the Rollins band, I finished the band tour. We made the Lifetime record. They all went home, and I was in debt to all of them. I owed them all money. So I left on a talking tour. Like 3 days later, I'm doing that entire tour again. And so I got back to LA, December 87, and did two sold-out nights at the Lassa Club with Hubert Selby of Last Exit to Brooklyn fame opening for me.
Wow.
Crazy.
Wow.
And so from then to now, I now do 21, 22 countries. I sell out multiple nights at the Sydney Opera House. I mean, it's crazy.
It's unbelievable.
And, you know, I get amazing offers, like keynote our convention. What's the convention about? Software and progress, and make a speech about where the world needs to go in the future. Really? Oh, we think you're perfect for that. Okay. And speak at this commencement. Just get these kids out of college. I've done that a couple of times. I take work seriously. I take dedication seriously, but luckily I don't take myself seriously. And so it's opened up this whole other thing for me where I'm not the guy in a band. And a lot of my peers, they go out and we're doing the first album again 25 years later. Okay. Want to come along? No, I don't. I'll pay money. I'll go see it. But no. And so I don't have to go out there and remember this one, kids. Like my dad does. And so that's where it is now when you're almost 60. Like, you know, I see all these old men. I know that old guy from somewhere. Oh, of course, I'm his age. He was at my shows. I remember that guy. The smart thing I did as a younger man was one day I woke up in my bed and I went, I'm done with music. I don't hate it. I just have no more lyrics. There's no more toothpaste in the tube. I called my manager at the time. I said, I'm done with music. And that was, you know, 15% of that was a good thing for him. He's like, no. I went, yes. And so luckily I had enough, you know, movies, voiceover, documentary work, writing, talking, where that just filled in. And now I'm busier than ever. But I walked away before I had to start saying, hey, kids, remember this one? So I didn't have to put it on and go out there and put on the dog and yelp for my dinner. And I've had gentle discussions with major rock stars who you've produced. I'm, why you go out there? And I go, you go out and you play those same songs every night for the last 40 years. And one of these people, who I love dearly, said, yeah, that's what people want. I go, you want to give them what they want? He went, yeah. He's an older school guy, even older than me.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, that's, you want to make people happy. I'm like, you do? Huh. I never thought of that. That never once occurred to me. And he went, what do you do? I go, this is what I, what's on next? He went, huh, how's that treating you? I'm like, well, I need bus fare to get home. But but just two different schools.
Yeah.
And his whole thing is what you put on the show. Everyone goes, yay. You play what everyone wants to hear. And everyone's happy. And he said, you're not? I'm like, no, not necessarily. If they happen to like what I'm doing, cool. If they don't, they can bite me. And I'm sure in the last few years, he has sung that one, and that one for the 570 millionth time. And 50,000 people went, yay. That's just not for me.
There's no right way for any of this stuff to go. It really is up to the person.
It is. And everyone's fine. I mean, everyone's doing it their way as long as no one's getting hurt. I used to put bands down when I was a younger man. I had a big head full of steam. I can't do that now. music and culture, you know, America is in a very interesting time right now. I wouldn't say bad. I would just say eventual and interesting. It's been, we've been working towards where we are now for quite a while. I mean, if you watch this stuff, you're not that surprised. But as far as culturally, I don't know how much you voulez-vous and hobnob in L.A. I don't think L.A. has ever been cooler since I've been living here, as far as having an analog pulse, people you want to actually talk to again, clubs you want to go to, local bands you want to see every time they play. Like, if I was a younger man, I'd be out more often. I just can't do 5 hours of sleep and function all the time. I'd be out way more often because there's so many good bands and there's so many great clubs being run by thoughtful, conscientious people who love music.
Yeah.
I've never seen audiences so cool. The other night I was at the Palladium for Le Butcherettes, that's a band, and Bikini Kill, and it's like sold out four nights. It's a love fest in there. There's no fights. No one's getting their t-shirt torn off. No one's getting groped. And these are the gigs I see these days. I go to gigs and there's like all these gay kids there. Everyone's cool. I'm like, because that's nothing like the gigs I got, you know, it was a blender of flesh and testosterone when I got here. And so LA's never, in my opinion, never been a cooler place to dig what's happening. And so when someone gets cynical or everything sucks, I'm like, wow, you've just decided today sucks, because the truth is, it's really exciting and there's a lot of things to fix. But culture is really, I think, kind of is answering some howling, painful moan of homophobia that homophobia and racism and misogyny engenders or elicits. Music is going, oh, no, we got this. Here's the new, we're going to neutralize that with this. And so it's a great time to be open-minded. Things are better when you go to the gig. Everything's better once you're, you know, you perforate your can with a few holes. And I have to remind myself of that a lot. You know, I will sit alone and brood. So I push myself out the door.
Thank you for coming and having a chat.
Yeah, man. I hope that was, it was really fun to talk to you.
Same.
Thanks to Henry Rollins for taking the time to chat with Rick. You can hear favorite Black Flag and Rollins Band songs by heading to BrokenRecordPodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel at YouTube.com/BrokenRecordPodcast, where you can find all our new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at Broken Record. Broken Record is produced with help from Leah Rose, Jason Gambrell, Martin Gonzalez, Eric Sandler, and Jennifer Sanchez, with engineering help from Nick Chafee. Our executive producer is Mia LaBelle. Broken Record is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin Industries, consider becoming a Pushnik. Pushnik is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted ad-free listening for $4.99 a month. Look for Pushnik exclusively on Apple Podcast subscriptions. And if you like this show, of course, please remember to share, rate, and review us on your podcast app. Our theme music's by Kenny Beats. I'm Justin Richmond.
Every week at Broken Record, we meet with legends of the industry to uncover the meaning behind the music, the strategy and history that separate the good from the truly great. That's what Mark Chaikin does, but for the U.S. stock market. Mark is a creative legend in his own right. He worked on Wall Street for 50 years, invented three new indices for the NASDAQ, and has predicted some of the biggest market shifts of the past decade, including the recent mania in AI stocks. Now Mark says we're seeing a similar shakeup in the financial markets. He's calling this a new dawn for the U.S. stock market and predicts dozens of specific stocks will soar in the next 90 days. He put everything you need to know in a new presentation specifically designed for people off Wall Street. You can watch Mark's presentation for free at newstocktrend.com right now. Again, the link to watch is newstocktrend.com. That's newstocktrend.com. MuseAura is your access to online music lessons for guitar, piano, drums, and singing. This is your chance to reignite some old musical passions or pick up an instrument for the first time. Connect with more than 100 of the world's best teachers and musicians. You'll get 7 days totally free to try it out, and then it's just $30 a month, less than a single private lesson. I mean, why do we do Broken Record? Not just because we love hearing from great musicians. We do it because we think that there is something beautiful about the appreciation of music. Don't you think we need more of that in our lives these days? That's the mission of Musora, to inspire, educate, and connect musicians. Enjoy unlimited personal support, weekly live streams, student lesson plans. It's like having a personal music teacher, only much, much better. Just go to musora.com, M-U-S-O-R-A.com, to start a new musical journey today.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.